Wow.
What's up?
I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
Chapter 1 of The Mysterious Stranger by Mark Twain.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Patrick 79.
Chapter 1.
It was in 1590, winter. Austria was far away from the world and asleep. It was still the Middle Ages in Austria, and promised to remain so forever. Some even set it away back centuries upon centuries, and said that by the mental and spiritual clock, it was still the age of belief in Austria. But they meant it as a compliment, not a slur, and it was so taken, and we were all proud of it. I remember it well, although I was only a boy. And I remember, too, the pleasure it gave me. Yes, Austria was far from the world, and asleep, and our village was in the middle of that sleep, being in the middle of Austria. It drowsed in peace in the deep privacy of a hilly and woodsy solitude, where news from the world hardly ever came to disturb its dreams, and was infinitely content. At its front flowed the tranquil river, its surface painted with cloud forms and the reflections of drifting arcs and stone boats. Behind it rose the woody steeps of the base of the lofty precipice. From the top of the precipice frowned a vast castle, its long stretch of towers and bastions mailed in vines. Beyond the river, a league to the left, was a tumbled expanse of forest-clothed hills, cloven by winding gorges where the sun never penetrated. And to the right, a precipice overlooked the river, and between it and the hills just spoken of lay a far-reaching plain, dotted with homesteads, nested among orchards and shade trees. The whole region, for leagues around, was the hereditary property of a prince, whose servants kept the castle always in perfect condition for occupancy. But neither he nor his family came there oftener than once in 5 years. When they came, it was as if the Lord of the world had arrived, and had brought all the glories of his kingdom along. And when they left a calm behind which was like a deep sleep which follows an orgy. Oh, Esseldorf was a paradise for us boys. We were not overmuch pestered with schooling. Mainly, we were trained to be good Christians, to revere the Virgin, the Church, and the saints above everything. Beyond these matters, we were not required to know much, and in fact, not allowed to. Knowledge was not good for the common people, and could make them discontented with the lot which God had appointed them. and God would not endure discontentment with his plans. We had two priests. One of them, Father Adolf, was a very zealous and strenuous priest, much considered. There may have been better priests in some ways than Father Adolf, but there was never one in our commune who was held in more solemn and awful respect. This was because he had absolutely no fear of the devil. He was the only Christian I have ever known to whom that could be truly said. People stood in dread of him on that account, for they thought that there must be something, well, supernatural about him, else he could not be so bold and so confident. All men speak in bitter disapproval of the devil, but they do it reverently, not flippantly. But Adolf's way was very different. He called him by every name he could lay his tongue to, and it made everyone shudder that heard him. And often he would even speak of him scornfully and scoffingly. Then the people crossed themselves and went quickly out of his presence, fearing that something fearful might happen. Father Adolf had actually met Satan face to face more than once, and defied him. This was known to be so. Father Adolf said it himself. He never made any secret of it, but spoke it right out. And that he was speaking true, there was proof in at least one instance. For on that occasion, he quarreled with the enemy and intrepidly threw his bottle at him. And there, upon the wall of his study, was the ruddy patch where it struck and broke. But it was Father Peter, the other priest, that we all loved best and were, well, sorriest for. Some people charged him with talking around in conversation that God was all goodness and would find a way to save all his poor human children. It was a horrible thing to say, but there was never any absolute proof that Father Peter said it. And it was out of character for him to say it, too, for he was always good and gentle and truthful. He wasn't charged with saying it in the pulpit, where all the congregation could hear and testify, but only outside, in talk. And it is easy for enemies to manufacture that. Father Peter had an enemy, and a very powerful one, the astrologer, who lived in a tumbled old tower up the valley and put in his nights studying the stars. Oh, everyone knew he could foretell wars and famines, though that was not so hard, for there was always a war and generally a famine somewhere. But he could also read any man's life through the stars in the big book he had, and find lost property, and everyone in the village except Father Peter stood in awe of him. Even Father Adolf, who had defied the devil, had a wholesome respect for the astrologer when he came through our village wearing his tall, pointed hat and his long, flowing robes with stars on it, carrying his big book and a staff, which was known to have magic power. The bishop himself sometimes listened to the astrologer, it was said, for besides studying the stars and prophesying, the astrologer made a great show of piety, which would impress the bishop, of course. But Father Peter took no stock in the astrologer. He denounced him openly as a charlatan, a fraud with no valuable knowledge of any kind, or powers beyond those of an ordinary and rather inferior human being, which naturally made the astrologer hate Father Peters and wish to ruin him. It was the astrologer, as we all believed, who originated the story about Father Peter's shocking remark and carried it to the bishop. It was said that Father Peter had made the remark to his niece, Margaret, though Margaret denied it and implored the bishop to believe her and spare her old uncle from poverty and disgrace. But the bishop wouldn't listen. He suspended Father Peter indefinitely, though he wouldn't go so far as to excommunicate him on the evidence of only one witness. And now Father Peter has been out a couple of years, and our other priest, Father Adolf, had his flock. Those had been hard years for the old priest and Margaret. They had been favorites, but of course that changed when they came under the shadow of the bishop's frown. Many of their friends fell away entirely, and the rest became cool and distant. Oh, Margaret was a lovely girl of 18 when the trouble came, and she had the best head in the village and the most in it. She taught the harp and earned all her clothes and pocket money by her own industry, but her scholars fell away one by one now. She was forgotten when there were dances and parties among the youth of the village. The young fellows stopped coming to the house, all except Wilhelm Meidling, and he could have been spared. She and her uncle were sad and forlorn in their neglect and disgrace, and the sunshine had gone out of their lives. Matters went worse and worse all through the 2 years. Clothes were wearing out, bread was harder and harder to get. And now, at last, the very end was come. Solomon Isaacs had lent all the money he was willing to put on the house, and gave notice that tomorrow he would foreclose. End of chapter 1.
Chapter 2 of The Mysterious Stranger by Mark Twain.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Patrick 79.
Chapter 1.
Three of us boys were always together, and had been so from the cradle, being fond of one another from the beginning. And this affection deepened as the years went on. Nicholas Bauman, son of the principal judge of the local court. Seppi Wollmeyer, son of the keeper of the principal inn, the Golden Stag, which had a nice garden, with shade trees reaching down to the riverside, and pleasure boats for hire. And I was the third, Theodore Fisher, son of the church organist, who was also the leader of the village musicians, teacher of the violin, composer, tax collector of the commune, sexton, and in other ways a useful citizen, and respected by all. We knew the hills and the woods as well as the birds knew them, for we were always roaming them when we had leisure.
at least when we were not swimming or boating or fishing or playing on the ice or sliding downhill. And we had the run of the castle park, and a very few had that. It was because we were pets of the oldest serving man in the castle, Felix Brandt, and often we went there, nights, to hear him talk about old times and strange things, and to smoke with him. He taught us that, and to drink coffee, for he had served in the wars, and was at the siege of Vienna. And there, when the Turks were defeated and driven away, among the captured things were bags of coffee, and the Turkish prisoners explained the character of it and how to make a pleasant drink out of it. And now he always kept coffee by him, to drink himself and also to astonish the ignorant with. When it stormed, he kept us all night, and while it thundered and lightened outside, he told us about ghost stories and horrors of every kind, and of battles and murders and mutilations and such things, and made it pleasant and cozy inside. And he told us these things from his own experience, largely. He had seen many ghosts in his time, and witches, and enchanters, and once he was lost in a fierce storm at midnight in the mountains, and by the glare of the lightning had seen the wild huntsman rage on the blast with his specter dogs, chasing after him through the driving cloud rack. Also, he had seen an incubus once, and several times he had seen the great bat that sucks the blood from the necks of people while they are asleep, fanning them softly with their wings, and so keeping them drowsy till they die. He encouraged us not to fear these supernatural things, such as ghosts, and said they did no harm, but only wandered about because they were lonely and distressed and wanted kindly notice and compassion. And in time we learned not to be afraid, and even went down with him in the night to the haunted chamber in the dungeons of the castle. The ghost appeared only once, and went by very dim to the sight and floated noiselessly through the air and then disappeared. And we scarcely trembled. Oh, he had taught us so well. He said it came up sometimes in the night and woke him by passing its clammy hand over his face, but it did him no hurt. It only wanted sympathy and notice. But the strangest thing was that he had seen angels, actual angels out of heaven, and had talked to them. They had no wings, and wore clothes, and talked and looked and acted just like any natural person. And you would never know them for angels, except for the wonderful things they did, which a mortal could not do, and the way they suddenly disappeared while you were talking with them, which was also a thing which no mortal could do. And he said they were pleasant and cheerful, not gloomy and melancholy like ghosts. It was after that kind of a talk one May night that we got up next morning and had a good breakfast with him, and then went and crossed the bridge and went up into the hills on the left of the woody hilltop, which was a favorite place of ours, and there we stretched out on the grass in the shade to rest and smoke and talk over these strange things, for they were in our minds yet and impressing us. But we couldn't smoke,
because we had been heedless and left our flint and steel behind. Soon there came a youth strolling towards us through the trees, and he sat down and began to talk in a friendly way, just as if he knew us. But we did not answer him, for he was a stranger, and we were not used to strangers, and were shy of them. He had new and good clothes on, and was handsome, and had a winning face, and a pleasant voice, and was easy and graceful and unembarrassed, not slouchy and awkward and diffident like other boys. We wanted to be friendly with him, but didn't know how to begin. Then I thought of the pipe, and wondered if it would be taken as kindly meant if I offered it to him. But I remembered that we had no fire, so I was sorry and disappointed. But he looked up bright and pleased, and said, "Fire? Oh, that is easy. I will furnish it." I was so astonished I couldn't speak, for I had not said anything. He took the pipe and blew his breath on it, and the tobacco glowed red, and spirals of blue smoke rose up. We jumped up and were going to run, for that was natural, and we did run a few steps, although he was yearningly pleading for us to stay, and giving us his word that he would do us no harm, but only wanted to be friends with us and have company. Well, so we stopped and stood and wanted to go back, being full of curiosity and wonder, but afraid to venture. He went on coaxing in his soft, persuasive way, and when we saw that the pipe did not blow up and nothing happened, our confidence returned by little and little, and presently our curiosity got to be stronger than our fear, and we ventured back, but slowly, and ready to fly at any alarm. He was bent on putting us at ease, and he had the right art. One could not remain doubtful and timorous where a person was so earnest and simple and gentle, and talked so alluringly as he did. No, he won us over, and it was not long before we were content and comfortable and chatty, and glad we had found a new friend. When the feeling of constraint was all gone, we asked him how he had learned to do that strange thing, and he said he hadn't learned it at all. It came natural to him, like other things, other curious things. What ones? Oh, a number. I don't know how many. Will you let us see you do them? Do, please, the others said. You won't run away again? Oh, no, indeed we won't. Oh, please do, won't you? Yes, with pleasure. But you mustn't forget your promise, you know. We said we wouldn't. And he went to a puddle and came back with water in a cup which he had made out of a leaf. And he blew upon it and threw it out, and it was a lump of ice the shape of the cup. Oh, we were astonished and charmed, but not afraid any more. We were glad to be there, and asked him to go on and do more things, and he did. He said he would give us any kind of fruit we liked, whether it was in season or not. We all spoke at once. Orange, apple, grapes. They are in your pocket, he said. And it was true. They were of the best, too, and we ate them and wished we had more, though none of us said so. You will find more of them where those came from, he said, and everything else your appetites call for,
and you need not name the thing you wish. As long as I am with you, you only have to wish and find. And he said true. There was never anything so wonderful or so interesting. Bread, cakes, sweets, nuts. Whatever we wanted, it was there. He ate nothing himself, but sat and chatted, and did one curious thing after another to amuse us. He made a tiny toy squirrel out of clay, and made it run up a tree, and sat on a limb overhead, and barked down to us. Then he made a dog that was not much larger than a mouse, and it treed the squirrel, and danced about the tree, excited and barking, and was alive as any dog could be. It frightened the squirrel from the tree, and followed it up until both were out of sight in the forest. He made birds out of clay, and set them free, and they flew away, singing. At last, I made bold to ask him to tell us who he was. An angel, he said, quite simply, and set another bird free, and clapped his hand, and made it fly away. Well, a kind of awe fell upon us when we heard him say that, and we were afraid again. But he said we need not be troubled. There was no occasion for us to be afraid of an angel. And he liked us, anyway. He went on chatting as simply and unaffectedly as ever. And while he talked, he made a crowd of little men and women the size of your finger, and they went diligently to work and cleared and leveled off a space a couple of yards square in the grass and began to build a cunning little castle in it, the women mixing the mortar and carrying it up the scaffolding in pails on their heads, just as our workwomen have always done, and the men laying the courses of masonry. 500 of these toy people swarming briskly about and working diligently and wiping the sweat off their faces as natural as life. In the absorbing interest of watching those 500 little people making the castle grow step by step and course by course and take shape and symmetry, that feeling and awe soon passed away, and we were quite comfortable and at home again. We asked if we might make some people, and he said yes, and told Seppi to make some cannon for the walls, and told Nicholas to make some halberdiers and breastplates and greaves and helmets, and I was to make the cavalry with horses. And in allotting these tasks, he called us by our names, but did not say how he knew them. Then Seppi asked him what his own name was, and he said tranquilly, Satan, and held out a chip and caught a little woman on it who was falling from the scaffolding and put her back where she belonged, and said, she is an idiot to step backwards like that and not notice where she is about. Oh, it caught us suddenly, that name did, and our work dropped out of our hands and broke to pieces. A cannon, a halberdier, and a horse. Satan laughed and asked what the matter was. I said, nothing, only it seemed a strange name for an angel. He asked why. Well, because it's his name, you know. Yes, he is my uncle. He said it placidly, but it took our breath for a moment and made our hearts beat. He did not seem to notice that, but mended our halberdiers and things with a touch, handing them to us finished, and said, don't you remember? He was an angel himself once.
Yes, it's true, said Seppi. I didn't think of that.
Before the fall, he was blameless.
Yes, said Nicholas, he was without sin.
It is a good family, ours, said Satan. There is not a better. He is the only member of it that has ever sinned.
I should not be able to make anyone understand how exciting it all was. You know, that kind of quiver that trembles around through you, and when you are seeing something so strange and enchanting and wonderful that it is just a fearful joy to be alive and look at it. And you know how you gaze when your lips turn dry and your breath comes short, but you wouldn't be anywhere but there, not for the world. I was bursting to ask one question. I had it on my tongue's end and could hardly hold it back, but I was ashamed to ask it. It might be a rudeness. Satan set an ox stand that he had been making and smiled up at me and said,
It wouldn't be a rudeness, and I should forgive if it was. Have I seen him? Millions of times. From the time that I was a little child, 1,000 years old, I was his second favorite among the nursery angels of our blood and lineage, to use a human phrase. Yes, from that time until the fall, 8,000 years, measured as you count time.
8,000?
Yes. He turned to Seppi and went on, as if answering something that was in Seppi's mind. Why, naturally I look like a boy, for that is what I am. With us, what you call time is a spacious thing. It takes a long stretch of it to grow an angel to full age. There was a question in my mind, and he turned to me and answered it. I am 16,000 years old, counting as you count. Then he turned to Nicholas and said, No, the fall did not affect me, nor the rest of the relationship. It was only he that I was named for, who ate of the fruit of the tree, and then beguiled the man and the woman with it. We others are still ignorant of sin. We are not able to commit it. We are without blemish, and shall abide in the estate always. We,
two of the little workmen were quarreling, and in buzzing little bumblebee voices they were cursing and swearing at each other. Now came blows and blood. Then they locked themselves together in a life and death struggle. Satan reached out his hand and crushed the life out of them with his fingers, and threw them away, wiped the red from his fingers on his handkerchief, and went on talking where he had left off. We cannot do wrong, neither have we any disposition to do it, for we do not know what it is. It seemed a strange speech in the circumstances, but we barely noticed that. We were so shocked and grieved at the wanton murder he had committed, for murder it was. That was its true name, and it was without palliation or excuse, for the men had not wronged him in any way. It made us miserable, for we loved him and had thought him so noble and so beautiful and gracious, and had honestly believed he was an angel.
and to have him to do this cruel thing, oh, it lowered him so, and we had such pride in him. He went right on talking, just as if nothing had happened, telling about his travels and the interesting things he had seen in the big worlds of our solar system and of other solar systems far away in the remoteness of space, and about the customs of the immortals that inhabit them, somehow fascinating us, enchanting us, charming us in spite of the pitiful scene that was now under our eyes. For the wives of the little dead men had found the crushed and shapeless bodies and were crying over them and sobbing and lamenting, and the priest was kneeling there with his hands crossed upon his breast, praying, and the crowds and crowds of pitying friends were massed about them, reverently uncovered, with their bare heads bowed, and many with the tears running down. A scene which Satan paid no attention until the small noise of the weeping and praying began to annoy him. Then he reached out and took the heavy board seat out of our swing and brought it down and smashed all the people into the earth just as if they had been flies, and went on talking just the same. An angel and kill a priest, an angel who did not know how to do wrong, and yet destroys in cold blood hundreds of helpless poor men and women who had never done any harm. It made us sick to see that awful deed, and to think that none of those poor creatures was prepared, except the priest, for none of them had ever heard a mass or seen a church. And we were witnesses. We had seen these murders done, and it was our duty to tell and let the law take its course. But he went on talking right along, and worked his enchantments upon us with that fatal music of his voice. He made us forget everything. We could only listen to him and love him and be his slaves, to do with us as he would. He made us drunk with joy of being with him and of looking into the heaven of his eyes, and of feeling the ecstasy that filled along our veins from the touch of his hand.
End of chapter 2. Chapter 3 of The Mysterious Stranger by Mark Twain.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Patrick 79.
Chapter 3. The stranger had seen everything. He had been everywhere. He knew everything, and he forgot nothing. What another must study, he learned at a glance. There was no difficulties for him. And he made things live before you when he told you about them. He saw the world made. He saw Adam created. He saw Samson surge against the pillars and bring the temple down in ruins about him. He saw Caesar's death. He told of the daily life in heaven. He had seen the damned writhing in the red waves of hell. And he made us see all these things. And it was as if we were on the spot and looking at them with our own eyes. And we felt them, too, but there was no sign that they were anything to him beyond mere entertainments.
those visions of hell, those poor babes and women and girls and lads and men shrieking and supplicating in anguish. Why, we could hardly bear it. But he was as bland about it as if he had been so many imitation rats in an artificial fire. And always, when he was talking about men and women here on earth and their doings, even the grandest and sublimest, we were secretly ashamed. For his manner showed that to him they were their doings, were of paltry, poor consequence. Often you would think he was talking about flies, if you didn't know. Once he even said, in so many words, that our people down here were quite interesting to him, notwithstanding that they were so dull and ignorant and trivial and conceited, and so diseased and rickety, and such a shabby, poor, worthless lot all around. He said it in quite a matter-of-course way, and without bitterness, just as a person might talk about bricks or manure or anything that was of no consequence and had feelings. I could see he meant no offense, but in my thoughts I set it down as, well, not very good manners.
Manners? He said. Why? It is merely the truth, and truth is good manners. Manners are a fiction. The castle is done. Do you like it?
Anyone would have been obliged to like it. It was lovely to look at. It was so shapely and fine, and so cunningly perfect in all its particulars, even to the little flags waving on the turrets. Satan said we must put the artillery in place now, and station the halberdiers and display the cavalry. Our men and horses were a spectacle to see. They were so little, like what they were intended for. For, of course, we had no art in making such things. Satan said they were the worst he had seen, and when we touched them and made them alive, it was just ridiculous the way they acted, on account of their legs not being of uniform length. They reeled and sprawled around as if they were drunk, and endangered everybody's lives around them, and finally fell over and lay helpless and kicking. It made us all laugh, though it was a shameful thing to see. The guns were charged with dirt to fire a salute, but they were so crooked and so badly made that they all burst when they went off, and killed some of the gunners and crippled the others. Satan said that we would have a storm now, and an earthquake, if we liked. But we must stand off a piece, out of danger. Well, we wanted to call the people away, too, but he said never mind them. They were of no consequence. And we could make more, sometime or other, if we needed them. A small storm cloud began to settle down black over the castle, and a miniature lightning and thunder began to play, and the ground to quiver, and the wind to pipe and wheeze, and the rain to fall, and all the people flocked into the castle for shelter. The cloud settled down blacker and blacker, and one could see the castle only dimly through it. The lightning blazed out flash upon flash and pierced the castle and set it on fire.
and the flame shone out red and fierce through the cloud. And people came flying out, shrieking, but Satan brushed them back, paying no attention to our begging and crying and imploring. And in the midst of the howling of the wind and the volleying of the thunder, the magazine blew up, the earthquake rent the ground wide, and the castle's wreck and ruin tumbled into the chasm, which swallowed it from sight and closed upon it with all that innocent life. Not one of the 500 poor creatures escaping. Oh, our hearts were broken. We could not keep from crying.
Don't cry,
Satan said.
They were of no value.
But they are gone to hell. Oh, it is no matter. We can make plenty more. It was of no use to try to move him. Evidently, he was wholly without feeling and could not understand. He was full of bubbling spirits and as gay as if this were a wedding instead of a fiendish massacre. And he was bent on making us feel as he did. And, of course, his magic accomplished his desire. It was no trouble to him. He did whatever he pleased with us. In a little while, we were dancing on that grave, and he was playing to us on a strange, sweet instrument which he took out of his pocket. And the music, but there is no music like that, unless perhaps in heaven, and that was where he brought it from, he said. It made one mad for pleasure, and we could not take our eyes from him, and the looks that went out of our eyes came from our hearts, and their dumb speech was worship. He brought the dance from heaven, too, and the bliss of paradise was in it. Presently, he said he must go away on an errand, but we could not bear the thought of it and clung to him and pleaded with him to stay. And that pleased him, and he said so, and said he would not go yet, but wait a little while, and we would sit down and talk a few minutes longer. And he told us Satan was only his real name, and he was to be known by it to us alone. But he had chosen another one to be called by in the presence of others, just a common one, such as people have. Philip Traum. It sounded so odd and mean for such a being, but it was his decision, and we said nothing. His decision was sufficient. We had seen wonders this day, and my thoughts began to run on the pleasure it would be to tell them when I got home, but he noticed those thoughts, and he said, "No. All these matters are a secret among us four. I do not mind your trying to tell them, if you like, but I will protect your tongues, and nothing of the secret will escape from them." It was a disappointment, but it couldn't be helped, and it cost us a sigh or two. We talked pleasantly along, and he was always reading our thoughts and responding to them, and it seemed to me that this was the most wonderful of all the things he did. But he interrupted my musings and said, "No, it would be wonderful for you, but it is not wonderful for me. I am not limited like you. I am not subject to human conditions. I can measure and understand your human weaknesses.
for I have studied them. But I have none of them. My flesh is not real, although it would seem firm to your touch. My clothes are not real. I am a spirit. Father Peter is coming. We looked round, but we did not see anyone. He is not in sight yet, but you will see him presently.
Do you know him, Satan?
No.
Won't you talk with him when he comes? He is not ignorant and dull like us, and he would so like to talk with you. Oh, will you?
Another time, yes, but not now. I must go on my errand after a little. Oh, there he is now. You can see him. Now sit still and don't say anything. We looked up and saw Father Peter approaching through the chestnuts. We three were sitting together in the grass, and Satan sat in front of us in the path. Father Peter came slowly along with his head down, thinking, and stopped within a couple of yards of us and took off his hat and got out his silk handkerchief and stood there mopping his face and looking as if he were going to speak to us. But he didn't. Presently he muttered,
"I can't think what brought me here. It seems as if I were in my study a minute ago, but I suppose I have been dreaming along for an hour and have come all the stretch without noticing, for I am not myself in these troubled days."
Then he went mumbling along to himself and walked straight through Satan, just as if nothing were there. Oh, it made us catch our breath to see it. We had the impulse to cry out the way you nearly always do when a startling thing happens, but something mysteriously restrained us, and we remained quiet, only breathing fast. Then the trees hid Father Peter after a little, and Satan said, "It is as I told you. I am only a spirit."
"Yes, one perceives it now,"
said Nikolaus,
"but we are not spirits. It is plain he did not see you. But were we invisible too? He looked at us, but he didn't seem to see us."
"No, none of us was visible to him, for I wished it so. It seemed almost too good to be true that we were actually seeing these romantic and wonderful things, and that it was not a dream. And there he sat, looking just like anybody, so natural and simple and charming, and chatting along again the same as ever, and, well, words cannot make you understand what we felt. It was an ecstasy, and an ecstasy is a thing that will not go into words. It feels like music, and one cannot tell about music so that another person can get the feeling of it. He was back in the old ages once more, and making them live before us. He had seen so much, so much. It was just a wonder to look at him and try to think how it must have been to have such experience behind one. But it made you seem sorrowfully trivial, and the creature of a day, and such a short and paltry day, too. And he didn't say anything to raise up your drooping pride. No, not a word. He always spoke of men in the same old, indifferent way, just as one speaks of bricks and manure piles and things. You could see that they were of no consequence to him, one way or the other. He didn't mean to hurt us. You could see that, just as we don't mean to insult a brick when we disparage it. A brick's emotions are nothing to us. It never occurs to us to think whether it has any or not. Once, when he was bunching the most illustrious kings and conquerors and poets and prophets and pirates and beggars together, just like a brick pile, I was shamed into putting in a word for man, and asked him why he made so much difference between men and himself. He had to struggle with that a moment. He didn't seem to understand how I could ask such a strange question. Then he said, "The difference between man and me, the difference between a mortal and an immortal, between a cloud and a spirit." He picked up a woodlouse that was creeping along a piece of bark. "What is the difference between Caesar and this?" I said, "One cannot compare things which by their nature and by the interval between them are not comparable." "You have answered your own question," he said. "I will expand it. Man is made of dirt. I saw him made. I am not made of dirt. Man is a museum of diseases, a home of impurities. He comes today and is gone tomorrow. He begins as dirt and departs as stench. I am of the aristocracy of the imperishables. And man has the moral sense. You understand? He has the moral sense. That would seem to be difference enough between us all by itself." He stopped there, as if it settled the matter. I was sorry, for at that time I had but a dim idea of what the moral sense was. I merely knew that we were proud of having it, and when he talked like that about it, it wounded me, and I felt as a girl feels who thinks her dearest finery is being admired and then overhears strangers making fun of it. For a while we were all silent, and I, for one, was depressed. Then Satan began to chat again, and soon he was sparkling along in such a cheerful and vivacious vein that my spirits rose once more. He told some very cunning things that put us in a gale of laughters. And when he was telling about the time that Samson tied the torches to the foxes' tails and set them loose in the Philistines' corn, and Samson, sitting on the fence, slapping his thighs and laughing, with the tears running down his cheeks, and lost his balance and fell off the fence, oh, the memory of that picture got him laughing too. And we did have a most lovely, a jolly time. By and by, he said, "I am going on my errand now." "Oh, don't," we all said. "Don't go. Stay with us. You won't come back." "Yes, I will. I give you my word."
"When?"
"Tonight."
"Say when."
"Oh, it won't be long. You will see."
"We like you."
"And I you. and as proof of it, I will show you something fine to see. Usually, when I go, I merely vanish. But now, I will dissolve myself and let you see me do it. He stood up, and it was quickly finished. He thinned away and thinned away until he was a soap bubble, except that he kept his shape. You could see the bushes through him as clearly as you see things through a soap bubble, and all over him played and flashed the delicate iridescent colors of the bubble. And along with them was that thing shaped like a window sash, which you always see on the globe of the bubble. You have seen a bubble strike the carpet and lightly bound along two or three times before it bursts. He did that. He sprang, touched the grass, bounded, floated along, touched again, and so on, and presently exploded. Puff! And in his place was vacancy. It was a strange and beautiful thing to see. We did not say anything, but sat wondering and dreaming and blinking. And finally Seppi roused up and said, mournfully sighing, "I suppose none of this happened." Nicholas sighed and said about the same. I was miserable to hear them say it, for it was the same cold fear that was in my own mind. Then we saw old Father Peter wandering along back, with his head down, searching the ground. When he was pretty close to us, he looked up and saw us and said, "How long have you been here, boys?"
"Oh, a little while, Father."
"Then it is since I came by, and maybe you can help me. Did you come by the path?"
"Yes, Father."
"Oh, that is good. I came the same way, but I have lost my wallet. There wasn't much in it, but a very little is much to me, for it was all I had. I suppose you haven't seen anything of it?"
"No, Father, but we will help you hunt."
"It was what I was going to ask you. Why, here it is. We hadn't noticed it, yet there it lay, right where Satan stood when he began to melt. If he did melt, and it wasn't a delusion." Father Peter picked it up and looked very much surprised. "Oh, it is mine," he said, "but not the contents. This is fat, mine is flat. Mine was light, and this is heavy." He opened it. It was stuffed as full as it could hold with gold coins. He let us gaze our fill, and of course we did gaze, for we had never seen so much money at one time before, and all our mouths came open to say, "Satan did it." But nothing came out. There it was, you see. We couldn't tell what Satan didn't want told. He had said so himself. "Oh, boys, did you do this?" It made us laugh, and it made him laugh, too, as soon as he thought what a foolish question it was. "Who has been here?" Our mouths came to answer, but stood so for a moment, because we couldn't say "nobody," for it wouldn't be true, and the right word didn't seem to come out. Then I thought of the right one and said it.
"Not a human being."
"That is so," said the others, and let their mouths go shut.
"It is so," said Father Peter,
and looked at us very severely. "I came by here a while ago, and there was no one here, but that is nothing. Someone has been here since. I don't mean to say that the person didn't pass here before you came, and I don't mean to say you saw him, but someone did pass, that I know. On your honor, you saw no one? Not a human being? Oh, that is sufficient. I know you are telling me the truth." He began to count the money on the path, we on our knees, eagerly helping to stack it in little piles. "It's 1,100 ducats odd," he said. "Oh, dear. Oh, if it were only mine. And I need it so." And his voice broke and his lips quivered. "It's yours, sir," we all cried at once, "every heller." "No, it isn't mine. Only 4 ducats are mine. The rest..." He fell to dreaming, poor old soul, and caressing some of the coins in his hands, and forgot where he was, sitting there on his heels, his old gray head bare. It was pitiful to see. "No," he said, waking up, "it isn't mine. I can't account for it. I think some enemy. It must be a trap." Nicholas said, "Father Peter, with the exception of the astrologer, you haven't a real enemy in the village. Nor Marget either. And not even a half enemy that's rich enough to chance 1,100 ducats to do you a mean turn. I'll ask you if that's so or not." He couldn't get around that argument, and it cheered him up. "But it isn't mine, you see. It isn't mine in any case." He said it in a wistful way, like a person who wouldn't be sorry, but glad if anybody would contradict him. "It's yours, Father Peter, and we are witness to it, aren't we, boys?" "Yes, we are, and we'll stand by it, too." "Oh, bless your hearts, you do almost persuade me. You do, indeed. If I had only 100 odd ducats of it. Oh, the house is mortgaged for it, and we've no home on our heads if we don't pay tomorrow. And that 4 ducats is all we've got in the it's yours, every bit of it, and you've got to take it. We are bail, and that's all right. Aren't we, Theodore? Aren't we, Sappy?" We two said yes, and Nicholas stuffed the money back into the shabby old wallet and made the owner take it. So he said he would use 200 of it, for his house was good enough security for that, and would put the rest at interest till the rightful owner came for it. And on our side, we must sign a paper showing how he got the money. A paper to show to the villagers as proof that he had not got out of his troubles dishonestly. End of chapter 3. Chapter 4 of The Mysterious Stranger by Mark Twain.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Patrick 79.
Chapter 4.
It made an immense talk next day, when Father Peter paid Solomon Isaacs in gold and left the rest of the money with him at interest. Also, there was a pleasant change. Many people called at the house to congratulate him, and a number of cool old friends became kind and friendly again. And to top all, Marget was invited to a party. And there was no mystery. Father Peter told the whole circumstance just as it happened, and said he could not account for it, only it was the plain hand of Providence, so far as he could see. One or two shook their heads and said privately it looked more like the hand of Satan. And really, that seemed a surprisingly good guess for ignorant people like that. Some came slyly buzzing around and tried to coax us boys to come out and tell the truth, and promised they wouldn't ever tell, but only wanted to know for their own satisfaction, because the whole thing was so curious. They even wanted to buy the secret and pay money for it, and if we could have invented something that would answer, but we couldn't. We hadn't the ingenuity, so we had to let the chance go by, and it was a pity. We carried that secret around without any trouble, but the other one, the big one, the splendid one, burned the very vitals of us. It was so hot to get out, and we so hot to let it out and astonish people with it. But we had to keep it in. In fact, it kept itself in. Satan said it would, and it did. We went off every day and got ourselves in wood so that we could talk about Satan, and really that was the only subject we thought of or cared anything about. And day and night we watched for him and hoped he would come, and we got more and more impatient all the time. We hadn't any interest in the other boys any more, and wouldn't take part in their games and enterprises. They seemed so tame after Satan, and their doings so trifling and commonplace after his adventures in antiquity and the constellations and his miracles and meltings and explosions and all that. During the first day, we were in a state of anxiety on account of one thing, and we kept going to Father Peter's house on one pretext or another to keep track of it. That was the gold coin. We were afraid it would crumble and turn to dust, like fairy money. If it did, but it didn't. At the end of the day, no complaint had been made about it, so after that, we were satisfied that it was real gold, and dropped the anxiety out of our minds. There was a question we wanted to ask Father Peter, and finally we went to the second evening, a little diffidently, after drawing stores, and I asked it as casually as I could, though it did not sound as casual as I wanted, because I didn't know how. What is moral sense, sir? He looked down surprised over his great spectacles and said, "Why, it is the faculty which enables us to distinguish good from evil." It threw some light, but not a glare, and I was a little disappointed, also to some degree embarrassed. He was waiting me to go on, so, in default of anything else to say, I asked, "Is it valuable?"
"Valuable? Oh, heavens, lad, it is the one thing that lifts man above the beasts that perish and makes him heir to immortality.
This did not remind me of anything further to say, so I got out with the other boys, and we went away with that indefinite sense you have often had of being filled but not fatted. They wanted me to explain, but I was tired. We passed out through the parlor, and there was Margaret at the spinning, teaching Marie Luger. So one of the deserting pupils was back, and an influential one, too. The others would follow. Margaret jumped up and ran and thanked us again, with tears in her eyes, and this was the third time, for saving her and her uncle from being turned into the street. And we told her again we hadn't done it. But that was her way. She never could be grateful enough for anything a person did for her. So we let her have her say. And as we passed through the garden, there was Wilhelm Meidling sitting there, waiting, for it was getting towards the edge of the evening, and he would be asking Margaret to take a walk along the river with him when she was done with the lesson. He was a young lawyer, and succeeding fairly well, and working his way along, little by little. Oh, he was fond of Margaret, and she of him. He had not deserted along with the others, but had stood his ground all through. His faithfulness was not lost on Margaret and her uncle. He hadn't so very much talent, but he was handsome and good. And these are a kind of talents themselves, and help along. He asked us how the lesson was getting along, and we told him it was about done. And maybe it was so. We didn't know anything about it, but we judged it would please him, and it did. And didn't cost us anything. End of chapter 4.
Wow. What's up? I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.